I remember to turn it on this time. What's going on? If you've got a Bible, you can go ahead and open to Song of Songs, chapter 5. The foundational basic thing that God says about you is that he created you to reflect his character. And the foundational basic thing that God says about himself is that he is love. Which means the fundamental truth of who you are is you were made by love and for love. The God who is love created you to live in his love. Your whole existence is supposed to be one everlasting dance of intimacy, this dialogue of longing and delight, of commitment and generosity. It is supposed to be sacred and joyful, a lot of responsibility, and a lot of fun. And yet, so much of our lives to this point have been about the absence or even the opposite of that love. We were created for the garden, and yet we wander around in the desert. Instead of longing, there's avoidance. Instead of delight, there's distrust. Instead of commitment, there's contract. Instead of generosity, there's transaction. We were made for this dialogue, and yet we've adapted to a life that seems to be mostly about either clamorous noise or awkward silence. The Song of Songs is this series of poems celebrating the intimacy for which we were made. These songs of love and longing and delight. And yet, right in the middle, there's a poem about when it all goes wrong. There's a song not of love, but of alienation. That's our text for this morning. And I want to read it all the way through, and then we'll go back piece by piece. And as I read it, do your best to kind of turn off your analyzer and listen with your heart, because it's a poem. It's not meant to give you a historical analysis of an event in a marriage. It's meant to give you an emotional, relational, spiritual impression of what it's like to be alienated from one you love. I slept, but my heart was awake. A sound, my beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one. For my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of the night. I had put off my garment. How could I put it on? I had bathed my feet. How could I soil them? My beloved put his hand to the latch, and my heart was thrilled within me. I arose to open to my beloved, and my hands dripped with myrrh, my fingers with liquid myrrh on the handles of the bolts. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had turned and gone. My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer. The watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, if you find my beloved, that you tell him I am sick with love. What is your beloved more than another beloved, O most beautiful among women? What is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us? My beloved, he is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water, bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. His cheeks are like beds of spices, mounds of sweet-smelling herbs. His lips are lilies, dripping liquid myrrh. His arms are rods of gold set with jewels. His body is polished ivory, bedecked with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns set on bases of gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet, and he is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. Where has your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned, that we may seek him with you? My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to graze in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He grazes among the lilies. This is a song that begins with alienation, and as we go through it, we're going to see that alienation happens, that alienation exposes, and that alienation passes. That's what's going on here. So first, alienation happens. This is the opening scene of the poem, verses 2-6 in chapter 5. We don't know exactly what happened. And we aren't meant to. We know very little of the facts. We can't even tell if this is telling a story where a guy knocks on the door and she refuses to open the door, or if the door is a metaphor and things actually got considerably more intimate before they went awry. We don't know. We don't know if things went wrong because of some misunderstanding or miscommunication, or maybe it was just bad timing, or maybe one or both of them sinned, was inconsiderate or self-centered in some way. We don't know. We just know that alienation happened. And we do know from context that this relationship between the two of them is a fundamentally loving one, right? If we back up just a couple of verses, right, the end of the last verse of chapter 4 and then chapter 5, verse 1, she says, "Let my beloved come to his garden and eat its choicest fruits." And he says, "I came to my garden, my sister, my bride. I gathered my myrrh with my spice. I ate my honeycomb with my honey. I drank my wine with my milk." And then this, like, crowd of women who are bearing witness, we're going to, Lord willing, talk about that a little bit more next week. They say, "Eat, friends, drink, and be drunk with love." This is a relationship that is going well. These two, they know about joyful intimacy. This is not a couple that is, you know, weighed down with guilt or feeling neurotic or repressed. They know how to delight and be unashamed. Right? And in the larger context of the story, they did all the things they were supposed to do. Like, they followed their youth pastor's instructions. They waited for marriage, right? And now it's all supposed to be great. This is the couple that when you see them on Sunday morning, some part of you thinks, if my marriage looked like that, if I had a marriage that looked like that, then I'd be happy. And right in the middle of this relationship, alienation happens. With the best possible circumstances, with a good background, she has to say, "My soul failed me when he spoke. I sought him, but found him not. I called him, but he gave no answer." Alienation happens in the middle of fundamentally sweet, fundamentally sound relationships. alienation happens. In the middle of a bed of beautiful and well-loved flowers, every day, weeds grow up. Alienation happens. This song, as much as it is in the midst of a whole book that is devoted to us celebrating and reveling in intimacy. Yes, bodily intimacy with a spouse, if you have a spouse, but all manner of intimacy. Intimacy with friends and siblings, intimacy with God himself. This song teaches us, in the midst of that, to expect alienation. To know that it's coming. To know that if we were really honest at wedding ceremonies, our vows would include, I accept that for the rest of my natural life, probably no one will hurt me more than you. And probably I will hurt no one more than you. As much as we love one another, we will also alienate one another. Because it happens. And the Bible does not pretend otherwise. It invites us to expect it. In marriage, in church, we will alienate one another. In spirituality, in your relationship with God, there will be alienation. Times when you sin and turn away from God, times when you try to turn toward God and all you can say is what she says here, I sought him and found him not, I called to him and he did not answer. Alienation happens. And we are taught to expect it and warned against hiding it or even minimizing it. We're warned against pretending that we don't experience it or pretending that when we experience it, it's not that big of a deal. In fact, the closer the relationship, the greater the intimacy, the more the alienation hurts. The bigger of a deal it is. Easily, the two closest and most important relationships in my life are with Vanessa and with Jesus, which does not mean that I don't experience alienation in those relationships or that I don't cause alienation in those relationships. And it does not mean that when that happens, I'm fine. It means that when that happens, it hurts more. It cuts deeper. It's scarier. One of the worst things that church can be is a place where people pretend that we don't experience this. A place where we have to pretend that we got married, we said the vows and we meant them, and now we're good to go. A place where I have to pretend that as the pastor, me and Jesus feel tight all the time. In my life, I have finished preaching a sermon and then walked right out of the sanctuary to go stand by myself in a field and yell at God. You say you're a father. How can you let what's happening in my family happen? Alienation. It happens. Right? Even when you follow the rules, right? Vanessa and I follow the rules. There's no yelling, there's no name calling, there's no throwing things, there's certainly no hitting. We don't have to. We can hurt each other in civilized tones of voice. choosing only the nicest words. In every relationship, you will experience alienation. And this text and hundreds of others are God saying again and again and again, you don't have to pretend that's not true. You don't have to put on your happy face. You don't always have to tell the story with a happy ending. Alienation happens. It happens, and when it happens, it exposes us. Right? Alienation happens, and alienation exposes. This song does not start off well, and then it takes a turn for the much, much worse. So there's been some sort of marital alienation between her and him. Things did not go well one night, right? And then, verse 7, the watchmen found me as they went about in the city. They beat me, they bruised me, they took away my veil, those watchmen of the walls. She goes out into the city at night trying to find her husband, and instead of finding her husband, she finds the watchmen, the cops. And instead of helping her, they hurt her. It's not clear whether it's they rough her up a bit or they go a lot further than that. But they definitely take advantage of the opportunity to take advantage of her. And then somehow she gets out of that, and she comes across some of the other women in the city that she's known that have been her friends, and she asks them for help. If they find her beloved, tell him. And they mock her. That's what her friends are saying in verse 9. And they say, what is your beloved more than another beloved? Oh, most beautiful among women, what is your beloved more than another beloved that you thus adjure us? You can understand, right? These women have been listening to her sing the praises of her husband and of their intimate relationship. And it rubs them the wrong way. They don't like hearing on and on and on about how happy she is. So finally, she's not happy. And they want to say, like, tell us again how it is that your guy is one among 10,000. How's that working out for you? So they're not nearly as sinister, malicious, and abusive as the watchmen were. But they don't act like friends. She experienced alienation with her husband. And that experience exposed her to these other situations that went a lot worse, where she was beaten up and derided. Alienation in the intimate relationships we want to be able to depend on exposes us to the downward spiral into the darkness of a world where relationships are mostly about exploiting and manipulating rather than loving and longing and delighting. Right? This is a dynamic that is responsible for some of the darkest stories in existence. A girl in a poor family in Bangkok ends up being sent away from home to help pay the bills. Maybe her parents genuinely believe that she's going to do laundry in the hotel on the other side of town, but that's not what she's going to do. Being alienated by her parents exposes her to the deepest darkness we can imagine. Alienation exposes in that sort of a way, and it exposes in far more subtle and presentable ways. A boy grows up in Southtown, lives a good life, goes to CHS. They have family dinner 5 nights a week. And it's only when he unexpectedly comes back from his freshman year of college that he realizes that any time he's out of the house, his dad sleeps in the guest room. That if his parents, his whole life, have been putting on a good face and practicing polite silence. And he starts to wonder, do I actually know them? Who are my mom and dad? And only begins once he gets married himself to realize how deep in his soul is the assumption that polite silence is the best you can do. That a healthy marriage is one in which you just don't talk about anything that might be upsetting to anyone. Being alienated from his mom and dad in a nice, middle-class, presentable way exposes him to a generational cycle of alienation. Alienation happens, and alienation exposes. And then, by grace, sometimes alienation passes. When, at the very beginning of the Bible, the first human beings introduce alienation into the world, decide to alienate themselves first from God, and then from one another, and then even from themselves. God comes and meets them, and he does not give them a way around. He doesn't give them a do-over or an opt-out. But he does give them signs that there will be a way through alienation. Knowing that they will be exposed now to the harshness of the world, he gives them clothing to protect them in the midst of their exposure. And he leaves a door, a way back into the garden, into intimacy, into a dialogue of longing and delight, as a way of letting them know that yes, alienation has happened, yes, it has exposed you, but it can pass. There is a way in which alienation passes, in which the loneliness and the mistrust and the cynicism that you understandably feel and experience day in and day out don't have to have the last word. This song that begins in alienation and then dives down into far deeper darkness, it ends in restored love and intimacy. That's verses 2 and 3 of chapter 6, where she sings, "My beloved has gone down to his garden, to the beds of spices, to graze in the gardens and to gather lilies. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He grazes among the lilies." This is language taken almost verbatim from the end of chapter 2 as a celebration, a culmination of their intimacy. Love has come back. Intimacy is restored. Things are as they should be once more. Alienation can pass. And this happens as a result of both of their persistent love. So we can really see the persistence of her love in this song, right? She goes after an initial hesitation or whatever is going on at the beginning, she goes out in pursuit of him, right? Into the city in the middle of the night, I need to find him. And she continues to look. And what's more, while there are some hints of her frustration with him in verse 6 of chapter 5, she's not pretending that there's nothing wrong with him. She spends far more time celebrating his virtues than she does grumbling about his defects. Right? The undertone of verse 6 really is like, where did you go? Why can't I find you? But then not the undertone, the explicit statement of verses 10 to 16 is, I love you and I delight in you. She persists in love for him. He's persistent too. He's the one who initiates at the beginning of the song, tries to seek her out. And then she thinks like he's run away off to some place where she'll never be able to find him. She finds him in the garden, which throughout the song is the place of their intimacy. So he doesn't run away from her. He runs to the place where he knows she'll be able to find him and their love can be restored. In this case, alienation passes because both of them are persistent in love. And there is a real application here, right? There is a real direct, be persistent. Don't give up easily. Alienation's going to happen. Don't respond to an experience of alienation with surrender. In the context of a basically healthy relationship, keep after it. Keep going through. That's absolutely there, right? Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Love never fails. Let's go for it, right? It's 16 and a half years in. Vanessa and I have not stopped alienating each other from time to time. But that experience has lost the sort of sense of looming permanency. Of maybe we're just going to be in the desert forever. Because a decade and a half of persistence has taught us that alienation does pass. So that application absolutely is there. That persistence is a virtue in love and that you can practice it. You can grow in it. Whatever your current physical stamina is, you can improve it through practice. The same thing is true of your relational stamina. Yeah? But that's not the main point. The main point is not persistent love causes alienation to pass. So be persistent in love. That's secondary. It's important to see this because, in case you aren't aware, your persistence will falter. To be persistent in love is always an act of courage. And you have a finite quantity of courage. You can increase it a little bit, but you can't increase it enough. To love someone is always risky, even in the context of a committed marriage. To love someone is always risky, and we run out of courage. We very quickly get to the point where we're both thinking, you know what would be really great is if you made the next move. I definitely feel like I could respond to your love in a loving way. But you know what I'm not going to do right now is make the first move. In order for alienation to pass, we need to be grounded in a relationship with somebody who always makes the first move. Somebody who always takes the risk. Somebody whose commitment to us doesn't falter. This song in verses 10 to 16 that she sings about her beloved, again, this is one of the clearest hints that the Song of Songs is not just about marital intimacy. Because this is not a song, ladies, that you should sing to your husband. I am not interested in having Vanessa look deep into my eyes and poignantly say, your body is polished ivory bedecked with sapphires. Right? This is not a good description of an ordinary guy. Right? This is a good description in cultural context of an extraordinary God. That's what's going on here. It's not some wife describing some husband. It's all of us doing our best to fumble through a description of God that exalts him enough, which it doesn't, right? But she's making a good faith effort. In order for alienation to pass in your life, you need to be grounded in a relationship with a God who always makes the first move. A God who takes on the risk of loving to you. A God whose commitment to you does not falter. And we have such a God. We have such a God in Jesus. There once was a woman. She lived in a town called Sychar, and life had etched the experience of alienation on her bones. She had been cast out by her husband, and having that alienation happen to her had exposed her to a cycle of exploitative, manipulative relationships where she traded the only thing she had left that men were interested in for temporary shelter and provision. Again and again and again. And had been trapped in absolute loneliness. Never able to be open or intimate with anyone, male or female. Until, in the middle of her daily rhythm of hiding from everyone, Jesus found her. Came to her at a well and took a profound risk for a man to be alone with a woman with her kind of reputation, for a Jew to be alone with a Samaritan. Sought her out. And at first, she responded out of her alienation, did everything she could to hold him at arm's length, told him he didn't belong there, that she didn't want anything to do with him, even pulled what is definitely an effective move with most religious teachers, tried to sidetrack him into a theological debate so he would stop talking about her and her heart. And Jesus would have none of it. Would not let her alienate him. But kept saying again and again and again, I'm here for you. I made this trip to meet you. I want you to be in my family forever. I don't want what you're used to offering. I want you. And this woman who had known only alienation her entire adult life is freed not only to be loved by Jesus, but to go skipping and dancing back into the town full of people who have despised her, to tell them, come and see a man who knows all of the shameful, alienating things that I have done and have been done to me and does not care, loves me anyway. Come and meet somebody who can make all of your alienation pass away as he has all of mine. Friends, alienation happens to you, and it happens through you. And exposes you to 1,000 different forms of ugly loneliness. And Jesus is not offering you a way around. He's not offering to help you avoid it. But in love, he has come into the midst of your alienation to meet you and lead you through, lead you into the life that you were made for, a life of love, of intimacy, of longing and delight, which will never end. Take him up on it. Let's pray. God, thank you for making us and for making us in your image to reflect your love. We are tired of reflecting loneliness and alienation instead. And we need your Son to rescue us. We need him to make the first move, and we need him to lead us in every move after that. We need the love you're offering, and we even need your help receiving it. Help, Lord. Amen. Stand.